It's the New Books and Literature Podcast. I'm Philip Woodavine, and today I'm joined by the fiction writer J. Robert Lennon. John is the author of seven novels, including Mailman, Familiar, and Happy Land, and recently the story collection See You in Paradise, which I had a chance to read and that we're going to focus on today. John, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to start, I guess, start with the outside. The jacket copy on this book says that it draws from 15 years of work, and I guess I was curious, were you working on these stories as a collection over that period, or is this like collected from things you had finished separately over that time?
I think I always thought I was working on a collection, but what collection it was changed fairly regularly. I think that I'm a novelist primarily. Although okay. I cut my teeth on short stories and love them very much and try to write several of them a year at least. So over 15 years, I maybe wrote 30 stories that I thought might be worth putting into a collection.
All right.
And after publishing a couple of novels with Grey Wolf, I thought it was, you know, I was enough of a known element with them that I could convince them to publish a story collection, which is a little harder sell, I think, than a novel.
Sure, sure.
And at that point, I sent my editor. I took the 30 stories and whittled them down to about 20, and then I sent those to him, and he cut 6, and then I asked him to put one back, and we were good to go.
What was the story that you guys were debating over? Just out of curiosity,
it was Weber's Head.
I like that one a lot, actually. I didn't see it coming at all. I was curious about what Weber's Head was going to be, and then it turned out to be Weber's Head. I guess that makes me curious. In either case, it seems like there was both an element of planning and an element of spontaneity there too. You're just sort of generating work, and then it becomes whatever final thing, you know, it ends up being, or how you work it out with your editors. But in either case, I'm curious about the long game kind of in fiction writing, being that most of the books in your bibliography are novels, and as you say, you think of yourself as a novelist. Is the shorter stuff what you find yourself doing on the side of that, or do characters and stories of the short work kind of divert from the same creative process? How does that kind of fit into?
I think the stories are a completely different endeavor, and they don't. I think I'm fairly methodical about novels. Now, I think when I'm writing a novel, I try to get into the feel of the thing and take it for what it is, and get, you know, let a certain degree of inspiration take over. But in general,
for sure,
I'm accustomed to trying to complete a novel every, you know, 3 years.
Right.
With short stories, I can't really plan for them. I mean, there are times when I thought, okay, I've got a few months coming up where I don't have any projects due, and my novel's been handed in, and I'm just going to write short stories, and then I don't. What usually happens is I'm in the middle of something else, and a short story occurs to me, and I just push everything aside and work on that. And if a story works, it usually comes very quickly, as opposed to novels, which of course are more laborious for most people anyway.
Sure. I actually had a creative writing teacher tell me that the short story was the end-based form, and you kind of had to – the end sort of had to be in some way prefigured in the very beginning of it. Do you find that to be true? Are you finding that maybe as opposed to a novel where, I mean, you're following maybe one character throughout one big, long experience, with a short story, do you find that when you start, do you know where you're going to end up?
No. I mean, sometimes I do. But sometimes I feel that way with novels. My last novel, Familiar, I had the last scene. I really had the last scene like 8 years before I wrote most of the book. Whereas the short stories, I think it's different every time. Sometimes, it often comes from a voice. The last story that's not in the book that I published, which is called, Breadman, came entirely from a voice and an experience I had in a coffee shop like 20 years ago. And I didn't know how it was going to end until I started writing it. Others, I do know the ending, and it's a place I want to get to. But I think the older I get, the less I feel it's possible to generalize where anything comes from, because I know for some writers, it's probably more consistent. And it was for me early on, maybe because I was, naive, not naive. I was, afraid. Well, I was definitely naive, but I was inexperienced and was kind of afraid to do something weird. And wanted to learn how to be a consistent writer who could always produce something. And I did things more or less in the same way. But these days I feel like I have a little bit more freedom to fool around.
Okay, that definitely opens up a question for me, which is just that has your experience of your creativity or your relationship to your creativity, has that changed since you started writing? I know that you were an MFA student at the University of Montana, right? So I don't know if your experience of the workshop was very much like my impression of it is now, which is where there's a model and you kind of have to follow it, and it's very like a realist school. So has your, maybe from the very beginning in the MFA to where you are now, has that experience of your creative work changed, or I guess your creativity, or how stories occur to you in a voice, or however they do?
I actually think of grad school and the couple of years after grad school as a kind of idealized, sort of a honey colored time. And something that I'm trying to recapture all the time. My workshop was I had pretty good teachers, I think. But it was a big workshop with a lot of people doing different kinds of things. And my wife and I and a few friends of ours were really into the kind of experimental we're into kind of the obscure corners of 80s fiction. And so a colleague recently said to me of my short fiction that the thing she liked about it was that I kept creating puzzles for myself to solve. I create problems for myself to solve, and each story is a self-contained problem. I never thought of that, but I found that both a flattering characterization and one that is maybe useful for me in analyzing and revising my own work. So that's what I was
going to do. That's cool, yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to use when I was in grad school, I tried to use the short story as a platform for experimentation. And not that I'm in any way an experimental writer. I'm only experimental in the sense that within my aesthetic, I want to try different kinds of things.
Right.
But I think that's still the case. And sometimes I will hit upon something. You know, the short story requires less of an investment of time and energy than a novel, and I'm much more willing to try something unusual. And occasionally that will lead to a frame of reference or a type of syntax or some other narrative quality that ends up informing novels. But I love my workshop. I love the fact that people argued a lot. I met four or five people who became my greatest critics, some of whom still are, and I think of as colleagues and friends. So, you know, and now that I have a full-time job and I have kids and other things I have to worry about, I think getting myself back into that headspace that I was in when I was, you know, 25 is a constant effort. I'm trying to do it right now, actually. Not right this second, but in the next week, I've got to get into revision mode for my next book. And I don't feel like a writer. I feel like a tired professor right now. And I got to.
Okay. I mean, it's the end of the semester. I guess that makes a lot of sense. I like a lot of the way you're talking about your approach to this stuff. Just thinking about syntax, even at the level of syntax. I kind of want to bring you back to this idea of a puzzle, though, because I like that a lot. And sure. I was reading a review of See You in Paradise by, I forgot his name, but he said that it kind of, the guy who was writing this review was sort of like had become bored with short story collections because he felt like it was just like the same thing over and over again. And he found your collection to be a pleasant surprise because it kind of read like a mixtape. Like it all sort of tied together in a way, but there was individuality within each story. And if we think of the story See You in Paradise as kind of like the title track of these collected fictions, I guess I'm really curious to hear what was the puzzle for you in that story? And how did you find yourself challenging yourself in that particular world and character and all that?
It was my publisher who chose that title. Like I agreed to it, of course, but I had preferred a couple of other titles, and they like that one. And they're the ones who thought that that story sort of stood for something. So I hadn't really thought of it until the book was called that. And then I guess I realized it was sort of true. I think the subject, the thing I was getting at in that story is this idea of a character who thinks he's one kind of person and he in fact is a different kind of person. And
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, there's another story of mine that's not in the book called The Impossible Man, which was in the Paris Review, and it's on their website. You can go and read it. But it didn't make the cut because a couple of other stories were doing something similar to it, including that one. But it's another story about a guy who really believes that he's one thing, and his everything he sees and thinks is filtered through, is rather bent through this prism, you know, or this lens of his own self-regard. And this is sort of a great fear of mine. Of course, I'm hyper-conscious of the notion that I am coming off differently from the way that I think I am. And I guess that's true of everyone, but it seems to
definitely. I mean, of me too. I'd say.
So that's the theme I was going for in there. And I think of the whole process of sort of trying to create the self as being ridiculous. And funny, so that, you know, the tone of that story came from that, the silliness of that struggle.
Absolutely. I was thinking of this. I didn't email this to you, but if you have a copy of it sitting around, okay, here's what I'll do. I think, and this can be a more heavily edited section. But if I send you the first couple paragraphs, I would love if you read the first two paragraphs of See You in Paradise.
Yeah. Go ahead and send them through.
I'll slot them in and then we can continue as if we never stopped.
Oh, editing. All right.
Yep.
Great. Sorry about that.
No, that's totally fine. I should have said something.
And actually, I probably have the ebook here on my laptop if that'll be quicker.
Oh yeah, do it. Okay. Yeah, actually.
Just let me open my ebook, whatchacallit.
Yeah.
All right. You ready?
Yep.
See You in Paradise. Brent Call was a pretty nice guy. He lived in a small rented house on a quiet street in the town where he went to college. He always shoveled his walk when it snowed, and he always said hi to passing neighbors. And though he was young, he graduated only a couple years before, he acted like he was 37, and everybody liked him for it. And Brent liked that everybody liked him. When somebody told him how much they liked one or another of his good qualities, he reacted by striving to enhance that quality so as to become nicer still. Nobody ever pointed out his bad qualities, which included gullibility, impatience, and a creeping smugness, because they thought it might upset him. And in this, they were right. In Brandt's world, people did not point out others' bad qualities. He grew up in the suburbs, hauled old ladies' trash cans to the curb, and was named after a beach in New Jersey. He was not introspective. It didn't occur to him that being universally liked might be a bad thing, or even illusory.
I like that. I like the readerly voice you kind of take on as you're reading that. It's like like the narrator or the
Only reading these two that I remember that the story even has an omniscient narrator who's making judgments, which kind of disappears later in the story. But I feel like the shadow of it still is useful for the for how you read the rest of it. I like to think
definitely. Yeah. I mean, you brought up syntax, and this is definitely true of See You in Paradise's story. One thing I appreciate about your characters is they seem to sort of inflect the narrative voice. So when it's the POV of Edward in No Life, the story about a couple looking to adopt, there's a lot of wows and yikes and judgment and single word sentences with exclamation points at the end of them. And in those moments, it feels like the story is being mediated more through Edward than, the standard omniscient narrator. Edward is in the third person. So, I guess what I want to say about that is that it seems like the diction, I should say with Brandt, there's things like a big honking donation or they got on just great and like smooching on benches. And it seems like these are things that the narrator in No Life wouldn't have said, or I don't think he would have.
And though there is an omniscient narrator here, it is channeling, it's the free and direct style. I think that's what James would call
it, or
indirect discourse or, however you want to refer to it. But this idea that the omniscient narrator takes on some of the, not the precise language necessarily of the character's thoughts, but the general feel of them expressed through diction and syntax.
Right. And I just kind of wanted to give a great example of that. In No Life, there's a sentence that goes like, or there's two sentences, and it's like, Edward finds himself on the floor, his legs splayed on the terracotta quarry tile, his back against the cabinets. Hey, how'd he get down here? So there's the narrator that knows that these tiles are terracotta quarry tiles, and then there's the splayed Edward who isn't quite sure how he ended up on the floor. So that's the vocab term, definitely. It's free and direct style. And it definitely allows for a huge amount of flexibility that I see in a lot of your stories. What I'm curious about is, to what extent do you find that the stories you're writing are told by you, the guy with a massive vocabulary, or by your characters who tend to vary from story to story?
Yeah, well, there's an old bit of writing advice that says your characters can only be as smart as you are, which I actually don't agree with, because in the microcosm of the book, you can take 3 years to do what is taking your character 10 minutes, you know, so you can make the character seem smarter than you by dint of your ability to take your time and do research and not be in the moment. However, oh, sure, there is, I do feel like, you know, I do feel like all these narrators are iterations of myself, and often the sound of my stories, especially the super short ones that mm-hmm. I've been publishing lately that haven't been collected yet, they're really about like patterns of mental repetition and kind of like tics almost. There's a bit where Brant in this story is bewildered at the idea that somebody might not like him. And one of the reasons is that I can't remember the exact examples, but he has these voices that he does, like what he thinks of as funny voices.
And, old Jewish lady.
Oh, duck. Yeah, here it is. Couldn't he do a wide range of voices, including old Jewish lady, old black guy, and duck? Which, you know, to the reader, this guy sounds like a clown, right? But to himself, he's thinking of these things as virtues, and I'm kind of conscious of the goofy voices I do around the house, and thinking, oh God, that's so much fun. I must be a riot. And of course, I'm not, but I do feel like this idea of talking to yourself and sounding a certain way when you talk to yourself and liking the sound of your own voice, though it may make you obnoxious in real life, if you're not careful, is actually very useful for a fiction writer.
It's hilarious in this story, I find. That was a great line that I thought I might bring up with you, but then you brought it up. And then further down that page, Brant has like an ellipsis, and then he says, maybe the love interest in the story's laughter was actually indecorous, and indecorous just seemed like a different person's word. So interesting interplay with those two things. So I kind of wanted to shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
And talk more about maybe composition and less so creativity or what you're tapping into. There's a snippet on YouTube of you posted by the Paris Review, and in it you say that even in good reviews, there's a sense that the reviewer is liking it wrong.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to proceed with that kind of in mind, that we might be talking in some way about two different books, and that we might have, or at least two different ideas of the same book, and that's interesting in itself, but then that kind of contrasts with another snippet of you on YouTube. You give a lecture called Thanks Blanks. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. It's Colgate.
Yeah. And in that, you say that's sort of how literature is actually working, is in its absences. And I guess a lot of what literature is doing, as opposed to film, for example, is sort of just giving the reader material to imagine their own worlds and characters with. So, I guess the question becomes, how much of what you're doing is actually what you're not doing, and when you're working on something, are you thinking about the role of the other person in the story, or leaving space for the reader to think about stuff, or how do you?
Yeah, I think you're always working the spaces, and once you do it enough, it becomes a kind of second nature where the you know, it's almost like the way the mic drop is the most important part of the speech or the song or the comedy routine. It's like the caesura when it's over and you get to react to it as the comic walks off the stage. I feel like the little performance that is writing that you're doing for an imaginary audience. There's lots of moments like that where you got to give a line space to resonate a little bit. I think one of the most common mistakes that's made by young but very competent writers, which is to say, like my graduate students, they're extraordinarily talented people, some of them quite a bit more talented than I am, but who have not generally become as confident as they eventually will. And as a result,
right.
kind of making sure they're being clear, which, you know, in some kinds of writing is extremely important, but in fiction and poetry, I think, and like creative nonfiction, just sort of leaving it out there, letting the penny drop for the reader and not showing it happening. It makes for a more powerful reading experience. And it's, you know, what's what we love about reading as opposed to other forms of narrative art,
right.
which are maybe a little bit more tyrannical by design.
Sure. Yeah. There's only one point of view in any movie, I guess, or there's one way to look at everything that's going on. That's a good point. And I kind of want to push you a little further on that, because there's, and I can't cite it, but I just sort of remember T.C. Boyle saying something about how writers, even though if they're writing in isolation or they're doing their work on their own in like solitude, they're still doing a kind of performance, you know, for the reader. Do you find that true of the short fiction that you're doing? Is there a sense that you're putting on a show, or?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, the shorter the story is, the more I feel that way. I actually just wrote a story that's like 1,000 words long. The last day when I teach the graduate workshop at Cornell, which I do every 2 years, we cycle through the faculty. I reserve the last day of workshop for everybody to write a 1,000-word story, including me. And we just all, you're not required to mark them up. You're not required to give everybody written memos. You just sort of have a free for all workshop, and it's a lot of fun. So, So this year I wrote one cause I have a reading coming up, in Queens next month, in which I only get 10 minutes at the mic. And I wanted to do something for, you know, that's performative, that's for a reading. And so when I started this, my story for the workshop, I thought, okay, I got to do something like that. But as I was writing it, I was definitely speaking it aloud in my head super loudly. I think when I'm writing a novel, again, other writers will probably respond differently to a question like that. But I find it more like it becomes less immediately verbal. It gets buried more and more into consciousness for me, which is not to say that I don't feel my novels have a voice. I think they do. But that is foregrounded in really short fiction. And I do definitely feel like I'm performing it as I'm reading it. And it, you know, it's also a byproduct of writing it quickly, which you can't really do with a novel. The fact that, you know, the idea that I'm taking a big breath and I'm just letting it all out over a certain number of pages, and then I'm done with it with a draft.
Right. That brings up another interesting question. When you're working so quickly with a short story, and as opposed to a novel, you're getting it all out in one kind of one sitting or one draft. Do you find that your revision process varies with the short fiction that you do, as opposed to the novels that sound like what is your main focus? Or
so you broke up a little there, but the question is the process changes from story to story?
So it seems like. Short stories are things that are moving more quickly, when you're writing them. Like the first draft is going to be done much more quickly, obviously, than a novel is. When you're revising, does it change the way you revise?
Yeah, I think it's not that everything is preordained, much as where the idea comes from, where the voice comes from, where the story comes from, has sort of profound effects on how I'm going to treat the writing all throughout the process of drafting and all of the revisions right up to the very end. So for instance, I just got an idea for a novel a couple of months ago. I've been writing these very, very short stories, with the same two characters in them. And all of them are between like 1 and 3 pages. And after giving a reading of one of them, someone told me I should, said I would read a novel of that.
Okay.
And so I started, I dragged a bunch of the stories into a new document and rearranged them and revised them a little and then added some stuff as though it were a novel. And I got about 30 pages of it. And it may or may not end up becoming a novel after I finish the thing I'm working on now. But the point is that it suddenly has shown itself to need to be written a certain way that is very different
from, sure.
from the manner I wrote the novel I just finished.
Okay.
And so it's like, you know, it's like, it's kind of a facile metaphor, but it's like any sort of human relationship. The things that were okay to say to one person are not okay to say to another. The things that please one person are not going to please another. And so the way, you know, if you're married to one person, your day-to-day life, your demeanor, the way you think about the things you say and do, is cast one way. And, if it were somebody else, you would be a different person. So I feel like with the novels and stories, you're trying on different ways of being, I suppose.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I guess, well, I'm really curious about this new thing that you're working on. Especially as something that started off in a much different form, like a shorter, smaller thing. Did you find as you were writing that, did the characters just seem to have more to them than that? Or were they, I don't know, I guess there's like a Mark Twain quote about how nobody sits down to write a novel. They just sort of, they make up some characters and see what happens. And if it goes for a certain number of pages, then it does. Is that been your experience with the novel you're working on now?
Do you mean the one I'm revising for publication or the one that I just conceived of?
The latter one.
Yeah. In this case, you know, I had no thought of making it a novel. I just thought of these two characters, really over the top, horrible people who are intentionally dislikable, who are married and have a terrible marriage, yet belong together and are never going to break up, sort of trying to endure what for other people are normal, you know, normal human interactions for them are a terrible strain. And it's almost like it's these over the top characters in a normal world, that contrast is supposed to be funny. And when I started writing these, I conceived of them as that they don't have names; they're just he and she. The dialogue does not. There's no quotation marks. The dialogue is just rendered in the same kind of prose as the narrative. So I have to be very careful tagging things. And then the effort of tagging things clearly gives it a certain, to me, appealingly artificial, repetitive, but in an almost, in a kind of litany of he said and she said.
I got you.
Yeah. So like the characters created the form, and then the form started iterating on itself and began to re-inform the characters. So, it's this kind of, closed universe of, kind of aesthetic choices that I made by accident. And trying to translate this into a novel is going to create differences as well from other ways of doing things. So it's true. I think it's, at least for me, and I do set out to write a novel often, but I always set out to write one novel and then end up writing another novel. I've said this before, or probably in interviews, but certainly to students, which is your novel is perfect until you write the first sentence and then it's ruined.
Right.
But you kind of have to, if you want to get anything done, you have to kind of accept what you're given to a certain extent and say, okay, I don't have that thing that I thought I was going to have, but I have this other thing instead. And this is also a thing. And maybe I can make something of this.
Definitely. Definitely. I don't have a segue for that. That's a big thought.
Okay.
I mean, I guess there was really one last question I had, and it's sort of like a biographical one. I mean, and it sort of relates to what we were talking about earlier, but how do you find your other roles in what you're doing now? You're teaching creative writing. I think I read that you're the director of the Cornell's creative writing program, or
that just changed. Thank goodness. That's been turned over to another professor. So I'm just a normal professor now.
Oh, right. I guess the question is, has teaching writing changed the way that you think about the, your own work or the work that you're doing now? Are you more attuned to, the nature and the patterns of storytelling that you now have to impart to other people? Does that change the way you think about your own stuff?
I'm sure it has. And occasionally something will happen that will show me how. But for the most part, it's a little bit mysterious to me. For instance, this semester, there's a thing that I do with intermediate, advanced, and graduate fiction workshops, which is I don't assign a great deal of reading. But I do assign an anthology, usually the latest best American short stories. And the question that I have students ask themselves, we ask each other, is not is this story good and why? But also, and maybe more importantly, why do people think this story is good? Why is this story in this anthology that is called the best American short stories? And what do those words mean? And why is it in here? And of course, you know, many of those stories I don't like, which is probably the case with everybody. But in my case, I start to see, and one thing we noticed this semester, me and the grad students, is everything increasingly seemed like a series of moves. And sometimes they're good moves. Sometimes it's like, oh, that move. I know that move. That's a good move. Other times it's like, oh, that move again? Are you really doing that?
Right.
I can't say that I like being that way. It feels ungenerous somehow, but maybe.
Sure.
So I'm tempted to think, yeah, maybe that comes from teaching. Maybe that comes from the need to take apart and instruct. On the other hand, maybe that's just from being a writer having tried out stuff and, you know, getting ideas that seem, you know, and it happens to everyone. I'm sure they have ideas that seem original to them, but have been done 150 times before in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is a good change in the way I see things or a bad one, or if it can even have a value attached to it. But it does, I guess I'm glad I've been a teacher. Ideally, if I were independently wealthy, I would just be sitting around in my sweatpants, making things up in my head all day, but I don't know if I would get more. I don't know if I'd get more done, or if it would be any better. And this engagement with people less experienced than I, and the need to justify to myself and other people the things that I do in my own work, I can't help but think is in some way beneficial to me.
Definitely. I mean, what occurs to me is that you have to think so much more closely about everything that you're doing. One thing that it seems to me what you're saying is that in having to teach writing, there are certain ways that what you like about writing becomes formalized, or it becomes more set and in a way that you can sort of talk about with other people or teach them. I guess what I would like, I'd be curious to know, in that kind of environment where what you like about storytelling becomes more formal or more set, are you still experimenting like you were back in grad school, or is that are you finding yourself trying to write another novel
I recently got a promotion at work. I became a full professor, which you get to do after a certain number of years and publications and so on. Which is, of course, like a great valedictory thing that I'm very happy about. But on the other hand, it's like there's that little part of me. It must be akin to the way some people think about marriage, though luckily I don't, which is, oh, shit, is it going to be this from now on, I guess? Oh, well.
Right.
And it made me realize that, yeah, it's very easy to feel that way about academia, about anything, but in this case about teaching, that like you've got your syllabi, you've got the things that you like to teach, You got your ways of doing it, and that's how you do it. And you can just keep coasting on that for the rest of your life if you want. I'm feeling the, certainly not the desire, but the tendency to get set in my ways, both as a teacher and as a writer. So the past few years, especially, I've really been working to, think a little bit differently about things and try to get back some of that experimental elan that I enjoyed when I was a graduate student. To that end, a couple of years ago, I started, one thing that always bothered me about myself was that I couldn't write longhand. It's many years since I've been able to write longhand and take myself seriously. I wrote one novel longhand, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then typed up the second draft on a manual typewriter as an experiment.
Okay.
But since then I've just been using a laptop like most people do. Then I switched to a notebook, again, 2 years ago and started doing stuff that lent itself to being written in a notebook. And that was interesting, and it made me write a different kind of short fiction. I'm sort of slowly cobbling together a collection of weird short things that maybe someday I'll send out as a manuscript, as a book. But for the time being, it's been my kind of experimentation lab.
Sure.
And I take things out of it and I put things into it, and I invent categories of things, and then I try to iterate within the category of thing. And that has it's influenced the novel that I have coming out next year or a year and a half from now, and is certainly influenced the novel that I just thought up and may pursue after I'm finished with this one. So I feel like things are looking up for me in terms of like keeping the excitement alive, the kind of keeping yourself in the dark so that maybe you bump into something interesting. I think when you get to be my age and you have a bunch of books out and you have a job that you can rely on, it's very tempting to not be in that mental space anymore.
Right.
And a lot of the time I don't want to be, you know, I would rather be comfortable a lot of the time. But I've been trying to fight against that recently, and I hope it's working.
Sure. It seems like kind of a, like you said, a laboratory that you can not only just work within, but take things out of and bring it to other things. Would you say like shorter pieces, like cobbled together shorter pieces, like, pieces for the left hand, would that be sort of, an experiment? Do you look at that as an experiment? Or?
Yeah, although this thing is a bunch of different kinds of things. Whereas that was a bunch of stabs at one kind of thing. There's a part of me that almost thinks of that as a novel, because it was always, after I'd written about 15 or 20 of them, it was always going to be a book. And I thought of it as, okay, look what I'm doing. I'm writing a book. I'll just do more of this. And then I sustained that over, I think I wrote maybe 110 stories and got rid of 10 in the end. So I think that is a project that was always of a piece. Whereas these things are almost pedantically aggressively trying not to be like each other. And if things have to be like each other, I sort of corral them into a little titled section. That kind of announces, here's a bunch of stuff that's this way, and here's a bunch of stuff that's another way, and then there's a bunch of standalone stuff as well.
Yeah, and in this collection, I guess, in particular, is the Accursed Items a name that you found applying to a bunch of entries in that same mode, I guess?
Yeah, although that's the oldest thing in the book. I actually wrote that at my desk at the first job I had after graduate school. I was the receptionist in an art museum, and they gave me even at the time it was old, DOS computer, I think it was an IBM computer with amber text on a black screen.
Okay.
And you'd run programs from the command prompt. And, and I wrote that story on this, on this computer, at my desk, and just, I think it was the first sort of successful in that I wanted to send it out and publish it, sort of odd little thing. And that kind of I guess that convinced me, okay, I can do these things out of school. Like I'm all, you know, or rather I'm always in school, you know, that's, I'm in the school that I'm the only student in now. And this is the kind of stuff I ought to make an effort to do. So that definitely in is a thing that I, especially when I was putting, See You in Paradise together, that I was looking back on and thinking, oh yeah, this is a thing I used to do and I should continue doing things like this.
Sure. Sure. Well, I think you've exhausted all my questions, and okay. So I'm just going to thank you again for coming on, and looking forward to seeing your new stuff.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.